So what's the next step?
The next step is thinking and rethinking. And the reason that this is so important is because it's one of those jobs that you need to apply now to the research you've done. And here's the point at which you might want to do another mind map, or you might not need another mind map at this point. But if you do, if you're not settled, then this is a good time to try it. The one thing I'd like to emphasize as part of the whole thinking and rethinking step is to strongly suggest to people that they avoid outlines. And
Really?
Yeah, and there's a very important scientific reason for this. And that is that our brains are divided into separate functions. And the part of the brain that is good at outlining is a linear, logical part.
Right.
And the part of the brain that's good at writing is a non-linear, emotional part.
Very interesting.
And if you you can't have those two separate parts of the brain in charge at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the metaphor I use is that it's like sharing driving with someone. You know, you can't have two people drive a car at the same time.
That's right.
One person gets to be in charge.
Right.
And if it's the outlining person, then you've got the linear, logical part of the brain that's in charge.
So what happens if you try to do it that way? If you try to outline all the major points in the article, do you get kind of stymied then when it comes to the writing?
Exactly.
It stops the flow?
Exactly. That's
interesting.
Exactly what happens. And as a matter of fact, I've had more people tell me that just that single piece of information has dramatically increased their writing speed more than anything else I've told them.
Wow.
So you really, really need to be able to get away from the whole outlining process.
Well, how about the macro view of outlining? For instance, a book has, 20 chapters, so...
Yeah.
You have the names of those chapters, and there might be sort of major sections. Is that okay?
What I'm talking about is actually for a small and contained piece of writing.
Right.
So I would say you maybe could go as high as 5,000 words. A typical book is about 80,000 words minimum.
Right.
And once you get to that many words, you can't hold it all in your head.
Sure.
So, yes, you're quite right. If you are writing a book, you have my official permission to do some outlining.
Yeah.
But then you have to put it away.
Not at the micro level.
No.
Sort of the big macro level.
No.
Right.
No, because then you're stuck in that mind map. Sorry, then you're stuck in that outlining frame of mind.
Right.
And you're going to have a hard time coming up with new ideas and new creative words and anything that's going to make the process interesting for you.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So that's the thinking and rethinking will often involve a mind map. It should definitely not involve an outline. And it should just get you ready to start writing.
You know, it's amazing the capacity of the human mind to hold all these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, sometimes I sit down to write my e-zine, and I actually don't know what I'm going to write, and I just sort of let my mind sort of whiz over a few things, and I go, well, that's good, and then I sort of think of the big picture, and then, I just jump into it.
Yes,
so,
right.
But not everybody can do it that fast. You know, I've been doing it for 12 years every week, so
right.
It's sort of second nature to me.
Yes, yeah. I've been doing it for about 3 years every week. And, when I first started my newsletter, I thought, when I first started, I was so naive. I wrote about 14. I accumulated 14 before I published my first one.
Oh, really?
and then spent the next 14 weeks publishing them and not writing a word.
Well, I do this thing, if I write it too far ahead, when it comes the day to write the e-zine, the one I wrote a week ago is like old news.
Yeah, I know.
And so I always just write it the couple days before, the day before.
That's exactly what I do now as well. Life is.
I like it to be fresh.
Yes. Yes. So. Yes. Exactly. So once you've finished thinking and rethinking, then you're almost ready to start writing. And what I call this step four is finding your lead. And this is a piece of terminology from the newspaper business.
Right.
I spell it in a funny way. Not everybody spells it this way. I spell it L-E-D-E.
Okay.
And I like that because it has a very specific meaning. And it means the beginning of an article. And the part about it that's specific is that the length is not spelled out in it. So the lead may be the first paragraph, or it may be the first 10 paragraphs.
Okay.
It really does depend on how you've produced that beginning. And generally speaking, with short articles, the lead is fairly short.
Sure.
And with longer articles, it's longer. But it really does depend on how you produce it.
So what is it? What's included in the lead?
Well, the lead is a bunch of different types of beginnings, I'll just go through them all rather quickly.
Okay, great.
And then I can give you a few examples.
But and this is so important because if you can't get it started well, you know, you're stuck.
Absolutely.
And once you get it started well, it's so much easier. So
exactly.
This is a big piece.
Yes, yes, yeah. So the first example of a type of lead is a true story or anecdote.
Uh-huh.
The second is very, very similar. It's an imaginary story or anecdote. So it's told like a story, but it didn't really happen.
Okay.
The third is an analogy, metaphor, or simile. The fourth is an interesting fact. The fifth is called the gallery. And what the gallery is, this is a little hard to explain, but it's a list of things or images that are spelled out. The magazine Newsweek will often use gallery-style leads at the beginning of a story. So just to make this one clear, let me give you an example. This one is in my book. So the story would begin, "The artwork of M.C. Escher shows strange and compelling worlds in which staircases appear to go nowhere and people sit upside down or sideways. The plywood pillar at your local museum is painted a creamy mottled white with deep gray veins and other flaws so it looks like real marble. When you put your dinner on a 12-inch plate instead of a 17-inch one, you eat less food and feel more satisfied by it. What do these three facts have in common? They are all optical illusions. Illusions are important in writing, too. A piece that looks great will read better than one that is visually dull or confusing." So what that is it's an assembly of facts.
And you use three in this case.
And I use three.
M.C. Escher, the marble, and food on your plate.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I almost always use three.
Uh-huh.
Three actually is a magic number in writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the three little pigs. There's the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Right.
There's a bunch of important threes in our world.
Right.
And when you do a gallery style lead, you want three things generally.
Yeah, two doesn't seem enough. Three fleshes out. Four is overkill.
That's right.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. So and then moving down the list, another one is an information withheld lead, and this sometimes gets known as a tease. And this is a lead that holds back a key piece of information. So just let me see if I can find one for you here. So here's one. "Things look serious at the Kamloops Cellulose Fibers Mill on September 15th. Two employees appear to have been exposed to chlorine dioxide, and they had to be treated and the mill evacuated. Fortunately, it wasn't a real emergency." So, and I'm trying to remember that story. I think what happened was just a first aid enactment. So they were trying to train people on how to deal with serious first aid situations.
But it stimulated your curiosity because you wonder, well, what really happened? It
exactly.
really wasn't serious. What was it all about?
Exactly.
Was it a false alarm?
Yes.
So that gets you interested.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. The next one is the wordplay lead. So this is often it's a joke. And let me find an example for you here. The Bean Education Awareness Network provides advice, recipes, and cooking tips for anyone contemplating moving towards a more meatless lifestyle. You might call the humble legume the bean of their existence.
The bean of their existence?
That's right. So that's just making a play with a word.
Right.
And that's enough to get you into a shortish story. I wouldn't use a lead like that for a long story because it's just not compelling enough. But
right.
for a short story, it's probably enough.
You really got me thinking with all of these. You know, I've got to ask myself, what kind of leads am I using in my articles, and do I have one that I fall back on too often?
Yes.
Because by doing this, you vary your writing and you make it more interesting by having different kind of leads.
That's right.
It's great.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And then the next one you can go with is a question lead. Now, the question lead is particularly can be problematic, and it's very important to be cautious with this one. What I say in my book, it's a bit like a loaded gun. It's as easy to shoot yourself in the foot as it is to hit the target.
Uh-huh.
'Cause one of the problems with questions is that it's possible for you to hear the question and then say, well, who cares?
Right.
And so as a writer, you do not want to write a question that is going to cause your audience say, who cares?
Right.
Because that means they're not going to read the next sentence.
It kind of stops people sometimes. It's like, do you find it hard to write? Well, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like, as opposed to, here's 10 ways you can write more effectively that draws you into it more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that one can be a challenge. And then the last one in the group I've identified is the quote. I do want to take a second here just to describe something that's very important. When I say using a quote at the beginning of an article, I do not mean just having a quote there. I mean doing some actual writing with it. So here's an example I used in one of my newsletters once.
Okay.
The charming quote, "I'm sorry to have written you such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one," has been variously attributed to a Chinese scholar, Oscar Wilde, Rudyard Kipling, George Bernard Shaw, Voltaire, John Steinbeck, and Blaise Pascal.
Now, I've also heard Lincoln and Mark Twain.
There you go. Two I left out. So the next sentence is, "Now, I'm not foolish enough to enter the argument about who said it first, but I will say this, it's utter nonsense." So that is beginning an article with a quote.
Yes, and it's a challenge, too.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. So when you want a quote, I don't recommend just having it in italics sitting at the top of your article, because then it's just a kind of an extra fill-up.
Yes.
But if you can actually work it into the text,
yes,
then you can create something that's interesting and very, very enticing to the
yes. person. Yes. One thing a lot of people say is, "I've heard," or "such and such is so and so and so," and then your take on it, which leads you into the
mm-hmm.
whatever. That's
yeah.
one way to do it.
Yeah.
Or I heard something recently on NPR radio that really got my attention. It was somebody that said, blah, blah, blah. "This got my attention because blah, blah, blah." So, yeah, it's a
right.
good way to start.
Yes, yeah.
It's a real thing. Someone said this.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so we've just gone through the first four steps. Those are all essentially planning steps. And now we are ready to launch into step five, which is the writing step. And the first thing I guess I want to emphasize is the writing step should not be the longest step.
Uh-huh.
It should actually be fairly short.
Uh-huh.
I'll just kind of jump ahead. This isn't available to the conclusion of my book, but just so your listeners understand that the preparation steps should take about 40% of your writing time.
Okay. Hmm.
And the editing steps, which are the steps at the end, should take about 40% of your writing time. And the writing should take about 20%.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, mileage will differ depending on a lot of things.
Yes.
But that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing, the most important thing to do is to kind of stay out of your own way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the hardest thing. And here's my sincerest piece of advice about this. And this will usually cause people to gasp. But what I recommend you do is turn your monitor off. Now, this does assume you are a touch typist. If you're not a touch typist, don't turn your monitor off. But if you are, you should give that a try. Because what happens is if you are looking at what you're writing all the time, you're responding to that. And what you ought to be doing is just kind of pressing ahead with the next point that you want to make.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, do you do that?
I don't do it all the time, but if I find myself slowing down, if I find myself editing, I had a horrible time with editing. I didn't like writing when I started, and I wanted to focus my time on editing, making my work better, making it more interesting.
Right.
And I found myself constantly getting sucked back into that system of fixing up the sentence I'd just written before moving on to the next.
And that's the killer, isn't it? I often say, write fast, edit slow.
Exactly.
And so what you're saying, one thing is, don't write a sentence and then go back and make sure the comma is perfect, there's no typos, and the structure is right, you can go back and fix that later.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do that, then you stop the flow of the ideas, and then it gets bogged down.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
So I just write.
Yeah.
And then you can go back and move stuff around. And yeah.
That's exactly right. You don't want to be doing that while you're trying.
So for the adventuresome amongst you, try that, turning your monitor off. I think that's fascinating. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. And the other thing for people, sometimes people get scared of doing that. So the other, less frightening alternative is to simply hang a dish towel over your computer.
Oh, yeah. Technically, that would probably be better.
Yeah.
So that's, even know if it's actually recording if the monitor's off, right? So, you know.
So you can just hang a dish towel over it and it's still there.
I'm going to try that.
Yes.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It's a bit scary, but it's fun.
Good.
So the main thing with editing is just to press through and press on and get as much done as you can. And when you're done writing, then you have to walk away from it for a while. And that is step 6, and I call that letting it incubate.
Yeah.
And that just means taking a break. Now, if you're very, very busy, or if, you want to produce X number of hours of writing a day, I'm not saying you have to not write. You just have to write about something else. So that's another option. Let's say you want to spend every Friday writing for 4 hours, and let's say you're doing a newsletter and you get your newsletter done after an hour. Well, you can spend the next 3 hours writing about something else. Write a chapter for your book, write on your website, write something for a client. You know, it doesn't matter. You just have to wait before you take the next, you move on to the next step.
And you know, Daphne, sometimes it can be a very short break.
Yeah.
Something that happens with me, I mean, it's kind of silly. It's like I finish writing, then I get up and I go to the bathroom or something, come back, and inevitably I get an idea when I'm away.
Yeah.
And it's often very, very quick for me.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm writing something bigger or longer or more substantial, I might even wait a day or so before I come back and reread it and edit it.
Yeah. The other thing you can do that I highly recommend is go for a walk.
Right.
Because there is a lot of evidence that walking leads to better writing.
Isn't that interesting?
It is. It is. And there are lots of other activities that tend to lead to better writing as well.
Exercising?
Certain kinds of low-level exercise. So, a slow jog would be okay. Once you get into something that's a bit more demanding, your your brain is too busy taken up with that.
Right, right.
But anything that is kind of mindless, quote-unquote, so, for instance, washing dishes, knitting, grooming a dog, those sorts of activities.
Listening to music,
tend to be very, very good at sparking your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, you can do what you want with incubating. The main thing is just not to be editing it or moving on to the next steps right away.
Great.
Once you've gotten through your incubating step, then you go to step 7, which is revising. And that's important because what you want to do is you want to read through the story that you've written very, very slowly. And with each sentence you read, ask yourself as a reader what it is you want to know next.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to make sure that that you answer that question that you want to know the answer to relatively quickly. And if you haven't answered the question quickly enough, that's when you need to do some rewriting. The other thing you need to do is you need to make sure that you have enough transitional devices in the text. So transitional devices are individual words like furthermore, therefore, similarly.
However.
Yeah, those kinds of words force you as a reader to go on.
Uh-huh.
They're really, really important in writing. So you want to make sure that you're using those whenever you can. The other thing you can use in addition to those words is you can use actual transitional devices. So you can pique your reader's curiosity by making intriguing statements that will raise a question in the reader's mind. You can use questions. So it's perfectly okay to use real questions in what you write. And they will predispose the reader to continue reading because the reader will want an answer to those questions.
Right.
You can also, if you're quoting someone in your text, you also want to set up the quotes. And what that does is that kind of paraphrases or introduces the quotes so that the reader gets some sense of who's going to be speaking next and what they're going to be talking about. And then the fourth thing you can do in terms of transitional devices is you can just repeat some key words or key ideas so that that helps pull the readers along.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, sure. So let me see. So if you're writing about transitions, you might say something like, let me see if I can find it here. Transitions needn't be complicated. In fact, the simplest is also one of the best. It's the word but. I always picture the word but as a big red stop sign that says to the reader, hey, heads up, we're changing directions here.
Uh-huh.
So what that does, that repetition of the word but, pulls you through the sentences and causes you as a reader to want to continue reading.
Very good.
Okay, so that's step 7, and once you're done that, then you move on to step 8, and this is probably the most time-consuming one, and that's copy editing. And there are a bunch of techniques that you use here to make sure that your copy is clean and tidy and organized.
So how is this different than revising?
Copy editing is, revising is about the big ideas behind your story.
Okay.
It's about the factual information that you want to convey to your reader. Copy editing is really about these small mistakes and errors that will slow the reader down.
Grammatical often, right?
Often grammatical. Sometimes
yep.
Spelling, sometimes punctuation, whatever. And so one of the things I like to do for copy editing is to put the word processor to work. So that means you're setting up your word processor to do the copy editing job, and then you kind of pull out the specific errors you're looking for. So
that is, with Word, it's going to find repetitions and misspellings and grammatical problems.
That's right. So one of my favorite ones is that you call up the find key, so it's Control plus F, you type in T-I-O-N, and then you do a search through your document for T-I-O-N, and you try and eliminate those words. And the reason is very interesting. T-I-O-N is a noun that has been produced from a verb. So, for example, observation.
Yes.
Comes from the verb observe.
Right.
And to make a sentence with the word observation, you have to add a different verb in there.
Uh-huh.
Usually the verb to be.
Uh-huh.
And if you can get rid of that and go back to the verb observe, then you have usually a shorter, more interesting sentence.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a new one on me.
Yeah, yeah. So you can...
watch T-I-O-N words.
That's right.
Interesting. They sort of slow things down. Okay.
That's right. And then once you've gone through the whole document for T-I-O-N, then go through for M-E-N-T. Because, again, they are a sign that you've taken a perfectly good verb and turned it into a noun. So, for instance, assignment should be turned back into the verb assign.
Uh-huh.
Atonement is atone. Development is develop.
Mm.
Engagement is engage. So, you know, what will happen is some people won't do this very much.
Yeah.
And if you start going through your copy and looking for these words and you're not finding them, then you can probably just eliminate that from your task list.
And, of course, not in 100% would you eliminate these, but you'd find some... If you're doing it too much, definitely to work on it, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. And then another thing you can type into the find box is IZE and search through your document.
Or for Americans, IZE.
Yes, yeah, sorry. My Canadian roots are showing.
eyes.
So maximize, monetize, optimize, randomize.
Uh-huh.
And what I don't like about these words is that they're generally mushy words, and you can usually just get rid of them. for instance, if someone says, are you monetizing your website? You know, a much more interesting way of saying that is your website making money?
Yes.
You know?
It's a little jargony when we use words like that.
Exactly.
I sometimes like to use those, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. So just get rid of them.
Yeah.
That's what copy editing is. It's basically going through a bunch of techniques.
And in your book, you have all these samples, right?
Examples. I do.
Is great. People have got to get this book. We'll be putting a link to Daphne's website where you can order the book.
Great.
But
thank you.
Definitely some great tips here. How about the famous passive voice?
Yeah.
Often people don't really get that concept versus the active voice. Can you give us some examples on why passive is not good in writing?
Well, passive is not good in writing because when you write, you want your readers to create strong visual images in their mind.
Okay.
And what a passive sentence does is that it hides who is doing the
action.
Performing the verb. Who's doing the action. So a passive sentence might be the butter is kept in the fridge. So who keeps the butter in the fridge? We don't know.
Has been done. All those
right.
are very passive.
That's right. Another example is the painting was stolen. Who stole the painting? Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
Another one is the road is being repaired. Well, who repaired that road? We don't know. What you can do is you can set up your grammar checker so that it identifies sentences that are passive.
Uh-huh.
And, I don't know that I will be able to explain that now. It is in my book, but you can... What I recommend is if you're not familiar with how to set up your grammar checker... you can either go to the help menu on your Word document, and it will explain to you how to set up the grammar checker.
Yep.
Or alternatively, you can get my book, and I have little pictures of screens.
Get the book.
Yeah.
It's much better than working with the word help menu.
Yeah, yeah, it's not so good.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's really interesting because we get into bad habits of writing that are unconscious. We're unaware of them. We wouldn't see them unless someone pointed them out to us.
Mm-hmm.
And you're giving us some great tips here to add more vitality to the writing,
exactly.
Is what I hear.
Yes, vitality.
And you're revising and copy editing.
Yes.
Editing.
So, and then the very last step that I explain in the book, and it's kind of separate to the writing, and it's the step I call the 8.5 step.
Right.
It's reading widely. And I don't mean reading what you're writing, although, of course, you should do that. My tip to read widely is to read what other people have written. And this can be outside of your general area of expertise. And as a matter of fact, I generally recommend reading outside of your area of expertise. Because what it does is it gets you into something different, and it gets you thinking about outside areas. And it gives you the opportunity to look at the basic architecture of how other writers write.
Well, all good writers read a lot.
Exactly.
It's kind of a rule of thumb.
Yes.
I remember in Stephen King's book on writing, he gave a list of all the books he had read that year.
Yes.
And it was extensive, including, you know, 5 Harry Potter books and God knows what else. A
mm-hmm.
Little more Catholic taste than I have. But, yeah, if you're not reading, you're really not absorbing these ideas and getting ideas and looking at how they're putting it together. I often do that. I wonder, God, I could never write like that.
Well, you know,
it's intimidating.
You know, the thing is, we could all never write like someone else. We
right.
can all only write like ourselves.
Right.
But if you read well and you read widely, you are going to start to pick up certain aspects of how other people write. And that will become merged with all the other readers you write. And over time, your writing will improve. And what that depends on is not just reading, say,
yes.
you know, you want to read beyond John Grisham. I'm not going to tell you that you should read the same writers I read. You know, you should read stuff that interests you. But what you want to do is you want to read a range of writers.
Yeah, and often this can be magazines. There are short stories in magazines, nonfiction pieces in all kinds of magazines.
Oh, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I heartily recommend The New Yorker. The thing about The New Yorker is that, first of all, it's really excellent writing.
Yeah.
Secondly, it covers a very wide range of topics. They do tend to get their feet stuck in certain areas. You know, the last issue I read was all about Obama. There was nothing else in the magazine except for a
right.
fiction article. But generally speaking, they have a wide range of subjects. The style of writing is quite different. And you can dive in there and find something that interests you and, you know, read something that's actually quite long.
They're very long. Often it's sort of first-person reported, you know, I'm following this person around for 2 weeks, and this is
yes.
everything that I learned about him and what he did and what his background was, and it's always fascinating. Those are the ones I say I could never read or write like that, because
yeah.
I do get The New Yorker.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've covered a lot of very valuable information here, and I think all the steps in your book are so powerful. I'm going to get more deeply into this book. I've kind of skimmed it, I have to admit it, and I'm seeing things that I really need to know more about that are going to make my writing better. Some are not such an issue for me.
Mm-hmm.
The initial planning and research is not such an issue for me,
yeah.
but I think the whole idea of the mind mapping and planning are extremely good ideas for people. Also realizing that it doesn't have to be academic writing or what your teacher taught you. It's
right.
a different way to look at it. Ways to do some research to get ideas, thinking and rethinking. And the thing I found the most fascinating, or one of the ones, is finding a good lead
yeah.
and all the different ideas around that. So it's a story, a made-up story, an analogy, a fact, a gallery of different things, information withheld or a tease, a wordplay, a question, or a quote. I took good notes.
Yes, yes. Those are, you know, that probably for many, many people in your group, I think that that particular technique would be almost the most useful for them.
Because it gets you started.
That's
and if
right.
you can't get started, you know, you can fuss around with your article for ages. But those techniques can give you a way to get going quickly
mm-hmm.
and make it more interesting.
That's right.
So I'm definitely going to study that part in more detail. And then the, you know, just getting into writing and let your pen think and covering your monitor and just sort of letting yourself flow, not worrying about it being perfect,
mm-hmm.
is really important advice for everybody because people, you know, they stop themselves and, you know, I've been working on two sentences for an hour. You're in trouble if that happens.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Yes.
People do that. And then going back and revising and moving things around and rethinking it a bit and playing with it. And then the copy editing, using... You know, I do copy editing, but I've never done it with this, doing a search function to find these different T-I-O-N, M-E-N-T, and I-Z-E, and passive voice, and that's very powerful. That could be quite revealing.
Oh, I love being able to do anything that puts the work on the shoulders of the computer rather than my shoulders.
Right.
It's very, very powerful.
You know, of course, these days, if you use Word, there's immediate spell check in it.
Yes.
So, you know, that's great. Often just changes it for you.
Yes. And the other thing, of course, is that we didn't touch on was the fact that the readability statistics are available for free in Word. I'm a little bit hooped right now because I switched to a Macintosh a while ago, and there's a bug with readability statistics in the newer versions of Mac Word.
Oh, it doesn't work?
No.
Oh.
No, it doesn't work. But I found a place on the internet where I can get readability statistics for free. And if anyone's on...
Where you just copy your text, paste it in somewhere,
yep.
and it will give you readability statistics?
Yes.
So what does that mean, readability statistics?
Well, it's an interesting little feature that you can get that basically measures the length of words and the length, the number of words in sentences and the number of sentences in paragraphs.
Uh-huh.
So, and what it does is it calculates those statistics and then gives you readability. And you want a grade level, ideally around about grade 9 for most
mm-hmm.
most reading, and then a percentage level at about 70%. There are different kinds of readability statistics, so they're all a little bit different. The numbers I just gave you are for the ones that are associated with Word. If you do it online, there are different kinds of statistics that where the numbers vary a little bit.
So can I just go to Google and put in readability statistics and find what I'm looking for?
You should be able to. I'm just going to see if I produce it for you quickly. Readability, yes. It's http://www.online-utility.org/english/readability_test_and_improve.jsp.
Okay, so don't worry about following that.
yeah, I know, it's a bit long.
But it will be in the text, and we'll actually have a link to that in the text. So
okay.
Just go to the text of the transcript of this.
Yes, and okay. then and if you have if you're working on a PC in Word, then you can set it up so that it operates with every Word document you do.
Great.
And for anything I publish, I run readability statistics on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, as just as a habit, I do, and it makes a difference. I mean, when I first started doing it, you know, I found that probably 50% of the time my readability statistics would be too high. Now I'm rarely too high, but I still do it as a matter of discipline.
Right. So slightly shorter words, shorter paragraphs,
yes.
Shorter sentences.
That's right.
So it's simpler to read.
That's right.
Okay, great. Well, Daphne, this has been a great interview. I've learned a lot from this, and even for someone who doesn't find it too hard to write, so people that are struggling with this, I think there's just a ton of useful ideas to get them started. And as we said, it's so important to write. It mm-hmm. really is the heart of your marketing.
Exactly.
I have one last comment. I say writing is pumping iron for marketing. That is, if you write, you build a muscle, and you build a marketing muscle.
Yes.
And if you don't write, that muscle is not developed, and you're not very good at being persuasive and communicating and getting people to take action. So mm-hmm. the more you write and follow these rules, the more persuasive you are and the better your marketing is.
That's right.
So thank you very, very, very much. I appreciate the time you took.
Great. Thank you, Robert.